everyone, and welcome back to the Mind Yourself podcast in association with Motus. Our next guest is researching something that is probably undervalued and underappreciated in society, and that is the mental health of young carers. Aoife Bowman-Grangell is an IRC-funded third-year PhD student who is supervised by Professor Stephen Gallagher and Dr. Jennifer McMahon. Her research is investigating the psychological well-being of young carers, and I'm excited to get into it. Aoife, thank you for coming on. How are you today?
Good, thanks for having me.
Very welcome. So, Aoife, starting off, as I already mentioned in the intro, I feel that carers and the psychological well-being of carers is undervalued. So why were you interested in researching this?
Yeah, so it is. You're absolutely right. It's very undervalued, specifically younger carers. So there is quite a bit of research and kind of traction surrounding the mental health and physical health of older carers. So like adults and older adults who are caring for spouses and family members like children. But there's kind of like a hidden army of younger carers who are under the age of 18 who are providing substantial unpaid care to family members who suffer from physical or mental illnesses, substance abuse issues or disabilities. And in Ireland, especially, and as well around the world, these people really are not considered within like healthcare settings, in education or in policy. And their mental health is really undervalued as well. So
you mentioned they're not considered. So this kind of ties in with my kind of next question in relation to like how do you define a carer? Like, is somebody taking care of their sibling, like babysitting every now and again, would that be classified as a carer? Or what exactly is it?
No, so we wouldn't classify them as a carer because that's considered kind of normative for children to do that and engage in those things. You know, it helps their development. A carer would be someone who provides additional care to someone who has additional needs. So outside of the normal realm of what you would consider just babysitting or something like that. So it could be a child or a teenager who cares for a sibling who has special needs. It could be a child or a teenager caring for a parent who has a disability or a physical or a mental illness. So that's kind of when we would consider them a carer.
And do you think that like children and adolescents who are doing this role, do you think they're aware of their role of doing that, or do they just think it's something that they do?
So I think they don't often recognize the extent of the care that they're providing, especially for younger kids. They, you know, they're sometimes maybe born into the role, or it happens when a sibling is born or their parent has had this illness for a long time. And it just kind of seems like something they do out of love and it's normal for them. And then for older kids and teenagers as well, they do it out of love for the person that they're caring for. So I don't think they recognize the extent to which they're doing it.
And so whose responsibility should it be to classify them as a carer? Like, should it be, let's say, you as the researcher, or should it be the child who is doing it, or should it be societies?
So that's an excellent question. Like, I would think, whose role is it? I suppose it probably starts with the parent, maybe, should try to identify if their child might be doing these additional responsibilities first with the parent. Also, though, in healthcare, I think would probably be the main one. So, for example, if a healthcare professional recognizes that there's someone in the family with additional needs, so they have a mental or a physical illness or a disability, and that there is also a child or a teenager in the home with that person, then they should be able to recognize that the likelihood is that person might be, that teenager or child might be taking on additional responsibilities. And they should flag that with the parent and with the young person and ask them. So that would be like an assessment of their caring responsibilities.
Okay. And then, so you mentioned like a carer could be related to, let's say, mental health or physical health, like chronic illness. Does the psychological well-being of the carer change depending on the type of care they provide?
Yeah, it does. So we actually did a piece of research with, it was a New Foundations Irish Research Council funded project in collaboration with Family Carers Ireland, which are a national charity supporting young carers in Ireland and older carers, and also UCC, so University College Cork. And we looked for just relationships between the type of caregiving task and psychological well-being. And what we found was that certain tasks, so for example, personal care tasks, so this might be helping someone to shower or bathe or dress or toileting, those tasks, as well as practical tasks, so like managing things like finances and helping them move around, so people with mobility issues, are linked to, you know, poor psychological well-being than say like other tasks that might just be cooking or cleaning or stuff like that.
Okay. And sorry, I should have asked this question before, but like, what is the general psychological well-being of carers in Ireland, and if possible wider, if you know?
So a piece of research that we done recently, so there's very limited evidence surrounding the actual psychological well-being of say, children and adolescents providing care in Ireland.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. Why?
That's a good question. Why is there? So I think because they're a hidden group, they're really hard to reach. They're hard to reach mainly because of stigma. So it's a kind of a stigmatized identity of being a carer. You know, people either don't want to disclose this information in education because they fear repercussions or they fear being treated differently.
Yeah.
And also maybe parents are unlikely to disclose their child's caregiving duties for fear of, you know, in unwanted input maybe. And also the fact that they don't really identify as a carer. So for children and adolescents specifically, they don't identify as a carer. You know, they just think they're doing this out of love. It's something that they do as part of their family obligations. So they don't identify. And then because of this, they're not being identified within healthcare and education. So it's kind of like an individualistic issue and also like a societal issue. Do you know?
So how, like, when you're looking at the research, like, how old does this go back? Like, when were carers first identified as a, let's say, subgroup?
Yeah. Like younger yeah. carers. So I don't want to say that there's no research on this, because that's not true.
Yeah.
There is quite a bit of research on children caring, like, globally. So the research does suggest that they have poor mental health overall. So they have things like they experience higher levels of loneliness and isolation, and they experience a lot of anxiety and depression. Hmm. So that's kind of what the research says. But in terms of the, like in Ireland specifically, the research pool is, the research base is really, really small. So what was your question again?
Sorry, I asked like three or four. I'm going to go back to, so like in Ireland in general, so you said the research is small, but
yeah.
From the research that you've done or that you've looked at, what is the overall psychological well-being of young carers at the moment?
Okay, so I would think that it's I don't want to generalize to all young people providing care, but from the research that I've done, so we recently did a study using the Growing Up in Ireland data set, which is a nationally representative population-based data set. So it provides, it's meant to be providing information on all aspects of young people's lives in Ireland, and they ask them a question about their caregiving responsibilities when they're 17 years old. So that was the population or the sample that we used for that study. And we examined depression in them. And we also, so there is some research to suggest that depending on who you're providing care for, your mental health might be differently affected. So say, for example, if you're providing care to a sibling or a grandparent, it mightn't be as harmful for your mental health as if you're providing care for a parent.
Yeah.
So we divided the carers up into carers who are caring for parents, carers who are caring for someone else, so a additional family member, and then non-carers. And we compared these groups, and what we found was that the young people who were caring for parents were almost four times more likely to be depressed and have depressive symptoms than the other two groups. So that kind of suggests that there is a real influence of, you know, who the care recipient is on your mental health. So it's not a flatline, all carers are depressed.
And why do you think that is? If you're having to care for a parent, it's so much worse. Why?
So I think there's a couple of different, like in theory, there's a few different reasons for this. So one might be this idea of parentification or role reversal, which is basically when the child or adolescent takes over the parenting over the adult. Okay, so this is, to what extent this occurs in young carers is yet to be determined, but kind of this has been identified in them, and that can be damaging for your mental health, because, you know, they're only teenagers, they're going through yeah. a lot of additional kind of responsibilities and life changes and transitions that they're kind of trying to navigate. And then in addition to this, maybe they're taking on more of a parenting role over the parent, and they have all these extra responsibilities that might be damaging, and it's kind of like rollover, like an overload outside of their capacity. Yeah. Do you know,
I suppose as well, I'm just thinking, like, would that also include, you know, sometimes maybe parents don't have mental health issues or physical health issues, but they're still being cared by their child. Is that possible?
So for maybe in an example where a parent is
just basically not being a good parent.
Yeah, absolutely. So you see this, it's, you know what, parentification isn't, it's not necessarily a thing that's related to carers. It's related to maybe instances where children are being neglected. So like in cases where a parent isn't caring for the child as they should, then they might have to take on responsibilities over their siblings or the parent. You know, they take on extra responsibilities that a normal child wouldn't. Now, I really don't want to say that young carers are being neglected. That is 100% not what I'm trying to say there. But that is just another example of where parentification occurs. And I think it's different in young carers, because a lot of the time, if they're caring for a parent, the parent is also caring for them. So it might be to a separate extent, and we actually haven't examined that, but that's just something that the literature kind of talks about, that it could be impacting their mental health. Yeah. But it's not involved in my research specifically.
Yeah, I think there's like an author, Simmons, it's basically like in adolescence, it's just the more stressors you have.
Yeah, I think it more is a case of trying to juggle all of the responsibilities you have as an adolescent and then having these extra responsibilities of being a carer. And I think it's not that caregiving per se is damaging for your mental health. I think it's when you're an unsupported carer. Yeah. That's when it becomes damaging.
And again, I know this isn't exactly your area, but do you think then if that adolescent who is taking care of their parent, if they identify as a carer, do you think that would be beneficial to their mental health?
So from like a personal identification point,
yeah,
I think it might be. I think if they can identify that they are a carer and find other people who are also identifying as a carer, then they can get that real peer support element. And that is actually something that we look at in my research. So in the study that I mentioned previously about depression, we looked at the influence of peer support. So the quality of the relationships that you have with your peers and whether this would influence their depression risk. And it actually found that, you know, having relationships that were characterized by enhanced trust and communication with your peers was really protective against depression risk. So I think if you can identify as a carer, find other people who also identify and they kind of share your experience, that might be really beneficial.
Yeah. So that shows the applicability of your research already, that we should be kind of trying to do better at that.
Yeah.
At helping children identify it.
Yeah.
And then sorry if you've already said this. So you said you looked at carers who were taking care of their parents, carers who were taking care of siblings or grandparents, and then non-carers.
Yeah.
Were there any differences between the carers who were looking at after grandparents or siblings and non-carers? Were there differences there?
Not at age 17, no. So which was really interesting. Yeah. Because we're kind of like, maybe what's going on there? Now, we were limited in the data set that we had that we couldn't actually delve deeper into that. But one reason that we might think that's the case is that carers who are caring for siblings and grandparents are often not a primary carer, they're a secondary carer. So they're providing care as part of a family unit alongside maybe their parents and other relatives who are all providing care together. So it's more of a supportive environment, whereas maybe an adolescent or a child who's caring for a parent might be acting as a primary carer. So they kind of have more caregiving tasks associated with the role.
Okay. And like, is there a possibility that it can actually be beneficial to be a carer at a young age?
Yeah, 100%. So if I think it can really, the research says that it has positive benefits. So for example, people find real meaning in being a carer. So yeah, it can help them to bond with the person that they're caring for and other members of their family as well. They also, in young people specifically, it really helps them to develop empathy, which is something that, you know, a lot of young people don't really have. It's a skill that you need to develop. So it helps them to develop empathy. It can also help them to develop competence, and they learn valuable skills.
Yeah, responsibility.
Yeah. So they learn skills. Like, so they're, absolutely, it's not a wholly negative experience. Like I said before, I think it only becomes negative when you don't have appropriate support. So if you don't have a family around you who can support you, if you don't have friends around you who can support you, and if you don't have formal support, so from organizations and specific support services that are meant to help you navigate this experience, I think it can be harmful.
Yeah. And so you mentioned Young Carers Ireland.
Yep.
That's a charity.
Family Carers Ireland.
Family Carers Ireland.
Yes.
So can you just talk about, like, so for anybody who's unaware, like, what do they do?
Yeah. So Family Carers Ireland are the national charity supporting all carers in Ireland. So they support carers from age 5 up to age 90, you know. And they are actually stakeholders in my PhD research. So Dr. Nikki Dunn, who is the research manager with Family Carers Ireland, is one of my supervisors for my PhD. And they have, specifically for young carers, they have a designated young carer group who provide supports and services for young carers.
Okay, and I'm going to push you on this. So like the supports and services, like what are some of them or what do they involve?
So they have a few. So say, for example, they do peer support groups for young carers. So they do these online. I know that weekly group meetings with where carers can kind of interact with other carers. So maybe that ties back into that identity piece where, you know, having someone else who's going through the same experience of you can be really beneficial for your health. And they also just kind of help them navigate all of the other things that might be going on. Like, do you know, like a lot of them are in school and they might be missing school, and because of their caregiving responsibilities and the schools don't really understand. So if they can kind of talk to some people who are going to appreciate that their experience, you know, that it's not their fault that they're missing school and things like this, it might be beneficial. I'm sure they probably do loads more supports that that could be explained better than that. But they do great things for young carers, and they try to kind of integrate the whole family as well, to work with the whole family as a unit, as opposed to just isolating the child or the young person providing care.
Okay, and they, so sorry, you said that they're a charity, so there's no actual like government organization involved with this?
No, not for young carers. So as far as I'm aware, there are no policies supporting young carers or even like mentioning any legal rights for young carers in Ireland. No.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to continue on in this topic then. What type of policies do you think should be there?
Well, that's an excellent question. So for example, in England, in the UK, they have really good policies set up for young carers. So it's illegal, or as of very recently, I think the last couple of months, healthcare professionals are legally obliged to try to identify young carers within the family. So that's a legal obligation now that they have to do that. And they have multiple charities and organisations set up to support young carers. And now that it's becoming a legal obligation for them to kind of support young carers and identify them, I can imagine that's going to only progress for, like, it's going to improve their mental and physical health and their lifestyles dramatically. What else? So they have, in the UK, they have these people called Young Carer Champions. So they are teachers within schools, and it's their job to identify young carers in schools and to also interact with the young carers and to try to, you know, just help them out in whatever they need. So I think, like, if Ireland could even get move towards sort of doing any of those things,
yeah,
we'd be in a much better position. Like right now, Family Carers Ireland and maybe some other organizations set up, like Care Alliance Ireland is another family care charity set up. I'd say they're the only two charities in Ireland maybe supporting young carers, apart from charities that deal with specific illnesses. You know, say for example, like ones like Huntington's disease and dementia charities might have integrated supports, but there's nothing like legally binding or in policy to support them.
Right. Okay. So would you say that the UK is like the best standard internationally, or?
Yes, probably. So there was research done, I think it was by Becker and Liu in 2017, and they kind of did like an inter-country classification of supports available to young carers, policies and research base. So they looked at those three things and they graded almost every country on a scale of 1 to 8, with 1 being the best you could be in terms of, you know, identifying young carers, providing supports and policy and having a solid research base, and 8 being the worst. And I think Ireland were ranked as 7. So they were, or maybe it was 6, but they were considered emerging. So, you know, there was some supports, nothing established in policy, and a very small research base, whereas the UK was ranked as 2. So they were quite advanced, like they have established policies in place and lots of working groups who are identifying carers. So yeah, they're kind of, if you were looking to a country to provide a basis for what we should do, they would be a very good one to look at.
Okay. And then my other question is, like, does this also include, like, I've two, no, I'll ask one first. You're specifically focused on young carers. So does age matter, like, in relation to it? Is, like, I know obviously the younger generally is probably the worst, but, like, is there kind of a cutoff point of, like, when you turn 18, does it become easier to become a carer compared to when you're an adolescent?
I don't think so. I don't think it's necessarily worse if you're a child compared to if you're a teenager or if you're a young adult. I think it depends on a lot of things. So it might depend on the onset of the person's illness or disability. So for example, if I lived a totally, you know, relatively normal life until I was 20, and then all of a sudden I had to start caring for someone, and I'm in the middle of college and I have all these other things going on, and maybe I'm out living away from home and I have to move home to care for this person, maybe that would be, you know, it would shock my whole life. So maybe that would be damaging to my mental health. Whereas if I had been caring for someone consistently throughout my whole life, maybe you have developed the skills and the coping strategies to kind of navigate that and to integrate it in. But I don't know. It's a good question. Like, that's kind of what we're looking at. So like with our research, we're looking at 17-year-olds. Or we looked at 17-year-olds, and it was actually a longitudinal study. So we looked at them when they were 17 and then again when they were 20. And it was interesting because caregiving predicted depression at 17. So caring for a parent predicted depression at 17 years old, but it didn't predict depression when they were 20. And okay. we saw a difference in depressive symptoms among the three groups. So what we saw was that the non-carers, depression increased. The carers who were caring for, say, siblings and grandparents, their depression increased. And the people who were caring for parents, their depression levels decreased.
Okay.
So that was really interesting and something we were trying to explain. But again, we're limited. It was very difficult to explain. So, I mean, at that time in a young person's life, there, we know that there is an onset of depression risk anyway, just because it's a vulnerable time. So maybe it was that the young carers had, the young parental carers, we'll say, had, you know, suffered depressive symptoms when they were 17 and then sought treatment in that meantime. And that's why their depression decreased. Or maybe they learned coping skills and they were able to kind of, you know.
Surely the relationship with the person they're caring for as well is like a big, big issue. Because I can imagine if you're 17 and you're caring for, let's say, a parent, you're thinking, if I didn't have to care for you, I could be here or I could
yeah.
be there.
Do you yeah. know? Yeah.
So there's kind of like this kind of internalized anger towards the carer.
Yeah, there might be. There might be. Now, it's not something that we looked at specifically.
Why did you focus on depression rather than any other psychopathology? Or was it just you were limited with the data set?
Well, no, we could have looked at anxiety. We could have looked at life satisfaction. And those are all other, like, you know, measures of kind of like psychological well-being. But we chose depression because, well, first of all, depression is a major issue in adolescents and young adults anyway.
Yeah.
So we kind of wanted to see if these young people were at risk of that. And also, a lot of the research was pointing towards like an increase in depressive symptoms. And depression also has like a really negative influence on your physical health, or it can. So it can either negatively affect like your health behaviors, so you'd be more inclined to smoke, like to, you know, abuse alcohol, to exercise less maybe. And it's also, what's the word? Reoccurring. So if you have experienced depression at one time in your life, you are way more likely to experience it again at another point in your life. And we actually found that the young carers who were depressed at 17 were 6 times more likely to be depressed at age 20, which is huge. Mm. So whatever is going on there, if you have an experience of depression, you're way more likely to experience it again.
There's like variables flying into my head now. You see, like another thing as well is, I wonder, there must be a degree of shame sometimes too for some carers, because they're thinking, let's say if they're not taking care of the person they're caring for well enough,
yeah
that can help develop depressive symptoms, you know, in that like I'm not doing enough, or like unhelpful thought patterns like we do in MOTUS.
Yeah
I had to bring that up. And then my other question then is in relation to, I wonder, I don't know if you come across this in the research, like the other thing, is it accounted for when you turn 18? Do many of these carers end up becoming like carers as a career? Do you know, like going to social care work and stuff? And then like, does it account for people who are carers as their job and then they come home and have to care for somebody at home?
So two questions there. We'll go with the first one. I do think, so in terms of if you're a carer as a child or as an adolescent, are you more likely to
go into,
do you mean like a profession yeah. as a carer? Maybe, because you've already kind of honed those nurturing skills and you've probably developed, maybe if you had a positive caring experience, then you might have found real meaning from that. And that might be something that you translate into your career. Yeah. Also, if that was a very negative experience, I'm sure you could go the total opposite way and not want to do that at all.
Yeah.
But that is a really interesting area of research. I do think that there is something to be said for developing those skills like empathy and nurturing and caring for someone. And I think that can be a really valuable experience. So I do think maybe they would be more inclined to.
Yeah, because then you open up a whole different research area when starting to think of like what makes a good carer then.
Like
maybe some carers, the reason why it has a depressive effect is because they're not good at it.
Yeah, maybe. You know? I think, yeah, like some people I think are not natural born carers, are they? Yeah. And especially for children and adolescents, they don't, maybe they don't have a choice. So you're thinking for an adult carer, they often have a choice whether they go into a caring role or not. Now, sometimes they don't. If it's a spouse or something, it's just kind of natural. But you're an adult. You have autonomy over the actions you do. If you're a child or an adolescent living in a house with your parents and you're reliant on them and you have a sibling or a parent who's ill, you're going to naturally take over that caring role whether you're a natural born carer or not, do you know? So,
did you find any gender differences?
Yes. So females are more likely to develop depression anyway.
Yeah.
We didn't look to see if there were gender differences on that depression study, but we did find that an interesting finding was that there were more male carers than there were female carers, which is not what the older adult carer literature says. So usually females take on caring roles for older adults, but...
But would you not argue that that's because maybe because stereotypically girls become carers, they're less likely to identify as a carer?
That's what I thought. So I thought that maybe these girls who are young, maybe they're less likely to be like, yes, I am a carer, because these are just things that they would do.
Yeah.
You know, naturally, they wouldn't think that they're additional responsibilities. So maybe the boys just identify more, or maybe there are just more of them, which...
Did gender moderate or influence the relationship between being a carer and depressive symptoms?
So we didn't look at the moderation for it. We didn't actually look at the moderation for that. But that would be a really interesting thing to look at. I would imagine it would. Now, we did... We're doing another study on cardiovascular health. So we wanted to... There's lots of research in the older adult care literature to suggest that caregiving... It is a chronic stressor, and chronic stress has an impact on your cardiovascular health. So we wanted to see if this would be replicated in younger carers. Do you know, like, how early are these effects observed? And we did see gender effects there. So there were differences between male and female carers on those cardiovascular outcomes. So we didn't look at it for depression, but we did see it for physical health, which is interesting.
And then just because you mentioned chronic stressor, I have to ask, I know you haven't looked at it yourself, but COVID wise, like, did that have a particular negative effect on carers? Or?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I think so. I know I didn't look at it myself. I was, you know, early in my PhD career at that stage. But all of the research out there does say that carers had a really, really difficult time during COVID because, you know, a lot of support services were cut straight away from them. So say, for example, if they had a person with a disability in the home who was, you know, going to support services like every day, and that was kind of respite for the carers, those things were all cut. So they were stopped. And then this meant that carers had to take on a lot of additional responsibilities. And this was, you know, like kind of like task overload. It was very damaging for their mental health. And also they were scared for the person that maybe that person is vulnerable to COVID. Now you have this illness that is going to, you know, it's saying it's targeting vulnerable individuals, and you're going to be afraid that you could maybe bring that into the home with the vulnerable person. So it was a very stressful time for carers. They had additional tasks and responsibilities, a fear for the safety of the person they're caring for, as well as their own safety. And then all of their outlets were taken away, the same as all of us. So no social outlets, no support. I'd say it was a very, very difficult time.
And then, so like we've mentioned gender, we've mentioned COVID. Surely socioeconomic status is a big, big role to play here too, that I'm guessing carers are far more common in those with low SES.
So I mean, for the older carers, I think there was a statistic from Family Carers Ireland that I read recently that said that a majority of carers lived in a household with an annual income of less than €20,000 a year, an annual income, which shocked me. Like, it was very low, do you know, to be caring for one person and let alone another person with additional needs. So for younger carers as well, we have seen in my research that they are more likely to be in those lower social classifications, like in terms of, especially if you're caring for a parent who has a disability or a physical or a mental illness, maybe they're not able to work. So you're kind of reliant on other means. Like financially, so that can be stressful too,
majorly, like even just thinking about it at face value. And then, like, going back to the government policy then, like, so like if somebody is like a carer as an adolescent, like do they get extra funding? Or
I don't think, now I'm open to being proven wrong on this one, but I don't think there is any any financial things that young people can apply for. I know that as soon as you turn 18 you can apply for the carer, like this care finance.
See, that's the issue, because it's so perpetuating. Then,
yeah, because
you, if you have an intelligent, let's say, adolescence, but they can't do school properly because they're having to care for somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very difficult. Okay. I was just thinking about, you mentioned a point earlier, it's been on the back of my head, of this kind of like, I think you called him a school champion in schools.
A care champion, sure. Yeah.
So like, as I picture that now, this is, I'm clueless on this area, but as I'm picturing that, it's kind of identifying adolescents who are caring and kind of helping them by, like, immediately what I'm thinking is practical stuff. Like, let's say, for example, they have to cook for their parents, but they can't cook. So like, kind of, you know, teaching them how to cook,
teaching them how
to clean correctly or efficiently. But like, is there the possibility of like interventions for young carers to improve their quality of life?
Yeah, I think so. I think like an intervention might focus on teaching them the basic skills that they need to kind of support the person that they're caring for and also to support themselves. And maybe teaching them some coping skills. So, for example, if young carers are adequately taught how to cope with their own mental health, maybe, so when they're experiencing stress, if they're taught effective ways to manage that stress, it might have benefits for their mental health in the long run. And then I think the main thing that they would really need is respite. So I think if an intervention was implemented, I think the most beneficial thing would be to give them a break, like to give them some time off. So yes, interventions would be important for training them and for teaching them how to cope with caring. But I think like the main thing is to give them a break and an outlet. So if they had a peer support group or like a group or just someone to come into the house and take a bit of responsibility off their hands, that would probably be the most beneficial thing for them.
Yeah, I'm immediately picturing as well, like, you know, let's say you're caring for a parent and you have a younger brother or younger sister.
Yeah,
you might feel like you need to do everything.
Yeah,
whereas kind of identifying what jobs are kind of, you know, like a younger person could manage, and then kind of sharing that responsibility as well to kind of ease it.
Yeah, so this whole family approach, this is kind of what experts in this area are opting for. So it's a whole family approach. So instead of just having an intervention targeted at that young person, you have interventions that are targeted at the whole family. So it's trying to set a plan that is achievable, that has goals for that family, that's going to be helping them to work together, because caregiving doesn't happen in isolation. Yeah. It's never just one person caring for someone else. There's always other elements and factors and people involved. So you really need to, you know, integrate the person receiving care and the care providers and help them to work together to kind of achieve the best possible outcome.
That's interesting too, because then I'd say it could improve the dynamics of the actual family as well.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Like,
so
somebody who's in like this stress torn house of having to care constantly for somebody might have a better relationship with their family than somebody who has no issues, let's say.
So I'm actually, just what you saying that, I'm going to bring it back to something we discussed a little bit earlier, which was about the quality of the relationship that you have with the care recipient. So I think that's a really important factor for being protecting against mental health. So caregiving is obviously a very stressful experience. So you can imagine a child caring for a parent, there might be elevated levels of conflict there because they're engaging with each other much more in a way that it kind of wouldn't be normative for most young people. So they're going to have maybe higher conflict. And if there isn't also a positive kind of relationship between the two of them, so something that's characterized by like intimacy and appreciation and expression of those things, we know that that's going to be damaging for the child or the young person. So they need to make sure that they have that positive relationship with the care recipient to be protect for their mental health, to show that what they're doing is being appreciated. And if, God forbid, there was a very negative relationship between the adolescent providing care and the care recipient, then that's obviously going to be very damaging for their mental health, because they're caring for someone who they don't feel like they have a good relationship with. So it's really important to make sure that that relationship stays positive as much as possible. So that's where the whole family approach could even intervene there as well.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then another aspect I'm just thinking as well is like just the importance of just telling these adolescent carers that, like, almost like compassion focused therapy, and that basically, like, you're expecting to do a lot, so you're going to fail sometimes, you know. That's the way it is. So sorry, I always like this kind of layered building, like this kind of how, like, you know, again, like how the MOAS program developed. But like, so would you say, like, at the very, very bottom, the first thing is to help adolescents identify that they're carers?
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
Second step then is the more practical type of stuff, so like kind of teaching them how to be a carer, and then also, as you mentioned, giving them that respite.
Yep.
Then then comes then like the coping strategies and dealing with their own mental health then.
So maybe, yeah. So those things, I mean, yeah, pretty much. Like, I think the most important thing that we need to focus on in Ireland right now is the identification piece. Yeah. And also, like, I find that a lot of carers, they first don't identify, and then it never gets acknowledged by someone else that what they're doing is additional. Do you know, it's never told to them, like, wow, what you're doing is great. You should be really proud of yourself. And that kind of brings in the compassion piece. And I think even just hearing that for that young person can be so important for them and so health protective, mental health protective, to just kind of, for them to realize that other people appreciate what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then you move on, of course, to the tangible support. So like what you said, like respite, practical support, teaching them skills to make their lives easier, and then also how to cope with the stress on a mental level. So,
but that's at the very, very top. It's not where you start, because I think this is where this involves SEL as well.
Yeah, yeah.
People think it's all the individual's responsibility, but you have to get the kind of practical things right first.
Exactly. Like, that's the thing. I don't want to put so much of an emphasis on, like, teaching. We need to teach these kids how to cope, because that makes it seem like, oh, you know, they should just be doing this and they should be able to do it, and you just have to cope with it then.
Yeah.
There's a real, like, idea. People within the young carer field, like, I know some of them really don't like the word resilience. Mm. So, like, they don't want to teach young carers to be resilient, because that teaches them that what they're doing is just, you just have to do it. You know, life is unfair. This is just a part of life. That is not what they should hear and what they should be taught. Like, these are additional responsibilities that even an adult would struggle to do. Mm. So, like, for them to be doing it is really, really amazing and inspiring.
Yeah, I think so, like, it goes back to, like, I've spoken about this in previous episodes. It's kind of like the SEL stuff, the, like, teaching the coping strategies, the emotion regulation strategies, that might help psychological well-being, but it doesn't prevent depression, anxiety.
No, so absolutely not. No.
Because there's bigger issues that are causing that. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And then, so, like, we've obviously named, like, loads of practical implications of your research. So, like, anything else that you haven't mentioned, maybe? It's okay if you say no.
Practical implications. I suppose... Well, we talked about, like, just the need in Ireland for policy. Like, this needs to be recognised at a level that's going to actually have an impact on Ireland as a whole, and then the identification within healthcare and education, and the identification at the personal level. That's really important. So kind of like awareness raising about young carers in all aspects of life. Yeah.
I think that's the case with so many things, though, where you have to identify it at a societal level before the government makes the change.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's what we're trying to do with our research, you know, is because the government won't, politicians, policymakers, they won't act unless they have a research base to go off of. So what we're hoping then, say, for example, with my research, is that I'll kind of highlight some of the experiences of young carers, and then it might be used by Family Carers Ireland, who feed it on to policymakers, who then will be able to implement those policies and kind of put in formal supports for carers.
Okay, four more questions. Okay. First one. So you mentioned that you were looking at cardiovascular research. So any other future research now that you're looking at in relation to carers in your PhD project?
Yep. So we've done all the quantitative research now. That's all coming to an end. The next step is to do a qualitative piece. So to do interviews with one-on-one with young adult carers. So we're going to be doing it with young people between the ages of 18 and 25 to kind of get their experience of caregiving. So that'll kind of really provide a grounding, you know, it'll help to explain all of the questions that we've talked about here, to kind of really give them a voice, because that's what we're trying to do, is to give them a voice and to learn more about their experience of caregiving in Ireland and what it's like for them.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Next one. I asked this to all researchers. If you had unlimited research funds, what would you be interested in researching yourself on the area?
So what would I be? I find I really do enjoy looking at the relationship between the parent and the adolescent. And I find that looking at maybe like mental health of the parent, so for young people caring for parents with mental health issues, and how that impacts the young person, I find that area really interesting. So I think that that's kind of like an under-researched area that I would like to delve into.
Parental mental health is a really good predictor of child mental health.
Yeah. So there's obviously a lot there. So there's genetics as well. Like, you know, is it genetic or is it a learned behavior or is it the fact that this young person is caring for their parent who has a mental illness? That's like, so there's a lot of things that I would like to delve into there to kind of
on that topic
out.
As well. Like, I also think, like, I think it's kind of like expectations and roles too. I think sometimes a parent might think you have to take care of me because I'm your parent.
Yeah.
And I think that's a kind of, in my opinion, a kind of wrong reason to care.
Yeah.
You know, because you create like an authoritative relationship then. And then
I saw there was a really interesting program on ITV2, I think, in October, and it was young carers in the UK, and there was this one young carer on it, and he was only, I think he was 12, and he had a really funny quote. He said, "My mom cared for me from until I was 10, so it's my turn to care for her now." You know, so he had this idea that now he's 12, he was like, I'm just kind of doing what I'm supposed to do at this age to kind of give back what she gave to me.
That would be the norm in some cultures as well, you know. So yeah, it's interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to hear the perspectives of the young people and how they view it. So,
Okay. Second last question I asked this to all the PhD grads is: you're obviously coming towards the end of your PhD. Well, hopefully. Any advice to any PhD students who are just starting now, or like, what would be your biggest piece of advice?
I suppose my biggest piece of advice would be to learn your area, to read around your area and see what other like scholars and academics and professionals have already researched. As that sounds basic enough, but like, you know, get to know your area, get to know as my supervisor Stephen would say, he would say, get to know the big players in your field and what they're kind of gearing towards, because that's going to guide your whole research area. You know, we all come into research with an idea of what we would like to look at.
Yeah.
But if that actually is just something, you don't want your research to be guided by interest alone. You want your research to be guided by what's actually going to be beneficial for your target population and what other people in the area have kind of looked at as well. And, you know, what's going to have the biggest impact. So
I think when people start, the first thing they always want to do is they want to start writing straight away, or like do data collection as quick as possible so that they can publish. But they don't know the field exactly, like you said. So yeah, I do think that's good advice, definitely in first year. Okay, and last question then, Aoife, is where can people find you?
So I'm on LinkedIn and my name is Aoife Bowman Grangel. I'm also a member of the SashLab Lab Group in the University of Limerick. I'm a member of the Health Research Institute in the University of Limerick. And I can share my email address with Christy. So he can share that too for anyone who'd like to contact me.
I will include that in the show notes. Aoife, I just want to say thank you very much. I didn't ask most of my questions that I have here in front of me. It was a very engaging conversation. So thank you for that.
That was fun.